Good morning, everyone. We're reading in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge. I think we've come to the middle of page 68. Perhaps we stopped at line 801 last week. 112?
Yes.
Okay, very good. So this He is the Divine playing the role of the soul, the individual soul in the universe. He is the many who was the silent one in the symbol figures of the cosmic force, all these many, many appearances that his own creative force has brought forth. And in her living and inanimate signs, and in her complex tracery of events, he explores the ceaseless miracle of himself. And he'll go on doing that until the thousandfold enigma, this complicated puzzle which he has set himself, till the thousandfold enigma has been solved in the single light of an all-witnessing soul. So we can go on from there. Paula, you like to start today?
This was his compact with his mighty mate, for love of her and joined to her forever, to follow the of time's eternity, amid magic dramas of her sudden moods and the surprises of her masked idea, and the vicissitudes of her vast caprice. Two seem his goals, yet ever are they one, and gaze at each other over bornless time. Spirit and matter are their end and source. A seeker of hidden meanings in life's forms, of the great mother's wide, uncharted will, and the rude enigma of her terrestrial ways, he is the explorer and the mariner on a secret inner ocean without bourne. He is the adventurer and cosmologist of a magic Earth's obscure geography.
Thank you. Anyone would like to ask anything about these lines?
If he uses the word enigma twice in this very short passage, or very short section, and I'm reminded of the Enigma project of World War II with the encryption of the German, the war and all that, and the British people who, it was a lot of women actually who did the project, and I think some of the last are just dying now. But it's interesting on the Enigma project was such a key to the defeat of the Germans.
Right. It's a word he uses quite often, that this whole universe is an enigma to us. Enigma was an excellent name for that project, yes.
Do you know the origin of that word?
It must be Latin or Greek, I'm not sure. What do you say? Enigma. We'll look it up in the dictionary and tell you next week.
Its meaning is an enigma.
Its
origin is an enigma.
Somewhere else they use enigma as norm.
Yes, yes. It's a very, very complex knot that we don't know how to untie it. And there's this famous story about Alexander the Great, when he set out on his conquest of the world, he came to a place where there was a very, very complicated knot, and rope. And he was told that only somebody who can untie this knot, who can unravel this complex enigma, will be able to conquer the world. And he took out his sword and cut it through. Yeah. But Sri Aurobindo says this is not the way to solve the enigma. It worked for a while for Alexander, but he tells us we are not allowed to cut that knot. We have to unravel it strand by strand. and to solve the enigma.
It was actually the wrote some small book, the enigma of the world.
The riddle. In French, maybe it's l'énigme.
It was given answer to Maurice Mann.
Yes, right.
His question is a Marvel question.
In English, it's the riddle of this world. And it's this riddle which bothers so many of us, that if God is benign and loving and the creator of all this world, why and how does he allow suffering and evil to exist? So Sri Aurobindo and the mother together give a beautiful answer in this little book, The Riddle of This World. So here, but he's telling us that it's the individual soul, the divine incarnated in each and every one of us, that we have to explore this ceaseless miracle of ourselves until we've solved this thousandfold enigma. It has a thousand puzzling aspects, and the way to solve it is to be found in the single light of an all-witnessing soul. On the page before, he told us our life is a paradox with God for key, and that to solve the riddle, we have to find this key that's hidden within us beneath the threshold.
So the dictionary here on the phone says that it is something or someone puzzling, mysterious, or inexplicable. And secondly, a riddle or difficult problem. It's synonymous with riddle, but it's something that can't be explained. But it doesn't say it can't be solved.
Does it give an origin? That's what we were wondering. What is the origin of this word?
No, it only points out this German device used during Second World War to encode strategic messages.
Yes. Okay.
Mine does give an origin. It says mid-16th century.
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
Mid-16th century, via Latin from Greek. From Ainos.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, it's from the Latin and the Greek, I see.
And then he tells us that the Lord has made a compact, an agreement with his mighty mate, with his creative force. For love of her and joined to her forever, he's going to follow the course of time's eternity, the eternal recurrence of time in the manifestation. He's going to accept all the magic dramas of her sudden moods and the surprises of her idea, which she keeps hidden from him and from us. And he's accepting to play this game in the vicissitudes of her vast caprice, all the things that she just does like that with no particular reason, just for fun, just for her delight. For us, they may be painful vicissitudes, all the ups and downs and shocks and surprises that we receive in life.
I like how he says here that the root enigma, he's the explorer. In other words, he's interested in discovering the...
Yes, he has to. That's what he has to do.
Take it and cut it violently, like
right. Yes.
That's interesting.
Don't miss out this interesting sentence. Two seem his goals. We seem to have two goals. One is the material goal, the other is the spiritual goal. But he says these are always really one, although they seem to be staring at each other across this unlimited expanse of time. Always they are one. And the soul is the seeker of hidden meaning in life's form. He's the explorer and the mariner who is trying to make a map of the great mother's wide, uncharted will. Nobody's ever made a map of her intention until Sri Aurobindo came along. He's trying to trace all out this rude enigma of her ways here on the earth, in the world of matter. That's the task of the soul, to be the explorer and the mariner on a secret inner ocean. It's not the external ocean, it's the inner ocean. Without bourne, there's no boundaries to that ocean. A mariner is a sailor, no? He's steering his ship on this secret inner ocean. And he's the adventurer, discovering new continents, new places, and the cosmologist, exploring the whole universe in which this magic earth has its obscure geography, the magic inner earth.
There's another definition of bourne that is given here that has to do with water. It says a stream or brook in which water flows only seasonally. Mm-hmm. That's interesting, huh?
That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, because this inner ocean is always flowing.
The line 820.
Yes.
The spirit and matter are their end and source. So I'm trying to see if end is spirit or source.
They're both ends and they're both sources. No? We can say spirit is the source of everything, but it's also the goal of our journey, isn't it? It's our destination, and matter is where we start from.
Those first three lines, if I may say, they inspire me to this idea that I have one day that we could have a new kind of sports, that the two goals are spirit and matter, that
Well, with a game, it is like that, no? It's just a temporary competition in which the two sides test each other's strength and development and skill, but they are not really opposites. They can interchange. They can have a friendly relationship and embrace each other when the game is over. That's the nice thing about sports. Shall we read on? Where did we start? Will you read, please? Yeah.
In her material order's fixed design, when all seems sure and even when changed the same, even though the end is left forever unknown, and ever unstable is life's shifting flow, his paths are found for him by silent fate, as stations in the ages in flood. Firm lands appear that tempt and stay a while. Then new horizons lure the minds of France. There comes no close to the finite boundlessness. There is no last certitude in which thought can pause, and no terminus to the soul's experience. A limit, a farness, never wholly reached, an unattained perfection calls to him. From distant boundaries in the unseen, a long beginning only has been made.
This seems to refer not only to the experience of the individual soul, but of the soul of humanity, that there are, it passes through certain stages, through all this flow, unstable flow of life. The soul's paths are indicated to him by silent fate, by the realities that he has to face in life. And sometimes it happens that the individual or humanity as a whole seems to reach some place in this flow of time, the weltering flood of time, that ocean, there seem to appear some firm lands, They may be only islands, or they may be whole continents. No? So when those firm lands are found, then this adventurer and explorer and cosmologist, he has to explore those firm lands. They prevent his forward movement for a time while he explores them. No? They stay him for a while. But then he becomes aware of new horizons which lure him further. And it seems that there's no close, there's no end to the boundlessness of this finite world that we live in. Sri Aurobindo uses this phrase, the boundless finite. I believe Einstein has also used this word. He recognized that our universe is finite. It is, in a way, limited, although our experience of it is boundless. And there's the image of an ant going round and round on a plate. No, he can't reach on the border of a plate. He goes around and around. He doesn't find any end to it. And yet still it has boundaries. So there comes no close to the finite's boundlessness. And for the mind, this means that there's no last certitude in which thought can pause. New possibilities are always coming up, new things to explore. And there's no terminus, there's no final destination for the soul's experience. There's always something calling further, another limit, a farness that's never reached, never completely reached. An unattained perfection is calling to him from what seem to be distant boundaries, horizons in the unseen. And so for the soul, it always seems that all that has been done is only a long beginning, a long preparation. The fulfillment still lies far ahead, so far ahead that the mind may doubt whether we can ever reach it. So I think this is the furthest we have read. Now there's the long last section we have yet to read before going into it in detail. And it continues this idea of the explorer and the mariner. Would you read, please?
This is the sailor on the throne of time. This is the world matters slow discoverer, who, launched into this small corporeal world, has learned his craft in tiny bays of self, but dares at last unplumbed infinities, the voyager upon eternity's seas. In his world venture's crude initial start, behold him ignorant of his godhead's force, timid initiate of its vast design, an expert captain of a fragile craft, a trafficker in small and permanent wares. At first he hugs the shore and shuns the breaths, dares not to affront the far off perilous main. Even a petty coastal traffic lies, his pay goes out from port to neighbor port, content with the safe ground's unchanging course. He hazards not the new and the unseen. But now he hears the sound of larger seas. A widening world calls him to distant scenes, and journeying in a larger vision's arc, and people's unknown and still unvisited shores.
Thank you. Don.
On at the mission keel, his merchant hull serves the world's commerce in the riches of time, severing the foam of a great landlocked sea to reach unknown harbor lights in distant climes and open markets for life's opulent arts, rich veils, carved statues, hued canvases and jeweled toys brought for an infant's play, and perishable products of hard toil, and transient splendors won and lost by the days, or passing through a gate of pillar rocks, venturing not yet to cross oceans unnamed, and journey into a dream of distances, travels close to unfamiliar coasts, and finds new haven in storm-troubled isles, or, guarded by a shore compass in his thoughts, he plunges through a bright haze that hides the stars, steering on the preludes of ignorance. His prow pushes towards undiscovered shores. He chances on unimagined continents. A seeker of the islands of the blessed, he leaves the last land, crosses the ultimate seas. He turns to eternal things, his symbol quest. Life changes for him in its time-constructed scenes, its images veiling infinity.
Thank you. Marie-Ange?
Earth's border recedes, and the fair terrestrial air comes from him no longer translucent way. He has crossed the limit of mortal thought and hope. He has reached the world's end and stares behind. The eyes of mortal body plunge their gaze into eyes that look upon eternity. The greater world times traveler must explore. At last he hears the chanting on the heights, and the far speaks, and the unknown draws near. He crosses the boundaries of the unseen, and passes over the edge of mortal sight to a new vision of himself and dreams. He is a spirit in an unfinished world that knows him not and cannot know itself. The surface symbol of the goalless quest takes deeper meanings to his inner view. He is a search of darkness for the light, of mortal life for immortality.
Thank you. Patricia.
In the vessel of an earthly embodiment, over the narrow rails of limiting sense, he looks out on the magic waves of time. The mind, like a moon, illumines the world's dark. There is then ever retreating from the eyes, as if in a tenuous, misty dreamland drawn, the outline of a dim, mysterious shore. A sailor on the inconscient, fathomless sea, he voyages through a starry world of thought on matter's deck, to a spiritual sun. Across the noise and multitudinous cry, across the rapt, unknowable silences, through a strange mid-world, under supernal skies, beyond Earth's longitudes and latitudes, his goal is fixed outside all present maps.
Thank you. Masumi?
But none learns whither to the unknown he sails, or what secret mission the Great Mother gave. In the hidden strength of her omnipotent will, driven by her breath across life's daunting deep, through the thunder's roar and through the windless hush, through fog and mist when nothing more is seen, he carries her sealed orders in his breast. Late will we know, opening the mystic script, whether to a blank port in the unseen he goes, or armed with her fear to discover a new mind and body in the city of God, and enshrine the immortal in his glorious house, and make the finite one with infinity. Across the salt waste of the endless years, her ocean waves impel his errant boat, the cosmic waters flashing as he goes, a rumor around him, and danger and a fall. Always he follows in her forces way. He sails through life and death and other life. He travels on through waking and through sleep.
Thank you. Tomoko.
How is on him from her occult force that ties him to his own creation's pain? And never can the mighty traveler rest, and never can the mystic voyage cease. Till the nascent dusk is lifted from man's soul, and the morns of God have overtaken his man. As long as nature lasts, he too is there. For this is sure that he and she are one. Even when he sleeps, he keeps her on his bed. Whoever leaves her, he will not depart. He reposes without her in the unknown. There is a truth to know, a work to do. The play is real, a mystery he fulfills. There is a plan in the mother's deep world wing, a purpose in her vast and random game. This ever she meant since the first dawn of life. This constant will she covered with her spirit. To evoke a person in the impersonal way, with a truth like strike earth's massive roots of trance, wake a bound self in the inconscient depth, and raise a lost power from its frequency, that the eyes of the timeless night look out from time, and the world manifest the unveiled divine. For this he left his white infinity and laid on the spirit the burden of the flesh, that Godhead's seed might flower in my mindlessness.
Thank you. So we can go back to the break on page 69 and look at this wonderful flow of significant images more closely. Mihong.
This is the sailor of the flow of time. This is a wild man's slow discoverer who launched into this small corporeal birth, has learned his craft in tiny ways of itself, but there's a last unplumbed infinities, a voyager upon eternity seas. In his world adventure's crude initial start, behold him ignorant of his large-headed force, timid initiate of its vast design, an expert captain of a fragile book, a trafficker in small impermanent wares, At first he hugs the shore and shuns the breath, dares not to affront the far off perilous main. He in a pretty costly traffic flies, his pay doled out from port to neighbor port. Content with his safe, round, unchanging course, he hazards not the new and the unseen.
Thank you. The individual soul, the soul in man, this is the sailor on the flow of time, the explorer and the mariner, the adventurer and cosmologist. This is world matter slow discoverer. That's what he sets out to explore first, the material world around him. This is the soul. He's launched on himself onto this ocean of time in this small corporeal birth, this individual form, bodily form. That's his boat. It was beautifully described a couple of pages back, no? And he says he's looking out over the rails of sense. Can't find it. Anybody remembers where it is? Or perhaps it hasn't come yet. It's on page 71. Yeah, it hasn't come yet. Yeah. So here we have the word craft used in two different ways. He's learned his craft, his seaman's craft, the art of sailing, of navigating his ship. He's learned it in tiny bays of self. It seems that human beings have done this really many, many thousands of years ago. They launched themselves onto the sea in safe bays. They went fishing. He learns to steer his craft, his body, to make use of his body. But in his development, he will at last dare the unplumbed infinitudes, the boundless, these infinities of consciousness whose depths have never been measured. He will become a voyager on the seas of eternity. But if we look at the beginning of his development, at the crude initial start of his world adventure, he doesn't know anything about his inner force, his divine Godhead. No? He's a timid initiate. He's just a beginner in this vast world design. But he has become an expert captain of this fragile craft of the body. No? And so what he does, he becomes a trafficker in small, impermanent wares. He carries perishable goods from one place to another for exchange. Trafficking is exchanging, commercial exchange. And on his first voyages, he keeps very, very close to the shore. He doesn't go out into the broad open spaces. It's too dangerous for him to try to go out into the perilous main. The main is the ocean. That's full of danger. So he stays close to the shore. That's quite dangerous enough. So he carries his small impermanent wares in this petty coastal traffic, plying backwards and forwards from one place to another. And his pay gets doled out to him from port to neighboring port. Perhaps even this is the image of a lifetime. You make one small journey and you get your pay, and then you have to do another one. But in that first stage, he's content with that safe round. It doesn't change, it's always the same. He doesn't risk the new and the unseen. This is the first stage in our human development where we're very much tied to limited experience, to the physical. Will you read? Severing.
opulent arts, reeds, bells, curved statues, hued canvases, and jeweled toys brought for an infant's and perishable products of hard toil and transient splendors worn and lost by the days.
Thank you. Thank you. Let's pause there. So this is another stage. First, he was content with his safe round's unchanging course. But now it's as if he hears the sound of larger seas. He's attracted to further adventures. A widening world calls him to distant scenes and journeyings in a larger vision's arc. This is something that happens in the evolution of our consciousness. At first, we're content with this safe daily round, but then a sense of adventure and curiosity wakes up in us, no? So he wants to go searching for peoples unknown and still unvisited shores. So how does he do that? On a commissioned keel, his merchant hull serves the world's commerce. A commissioned keel, it means that the boat that he's steering and looking after, in charge of, doesn't belong to him. He's been paid by somebody to make this journey. It's a merchant hull. The hull is the lower part of the boat. This is for commerce, and it serves the world's commerce, not just the neighboring village or a bit further and back. In the riches of time, he's carrying much more valuable products. With his merchant hull, he cuts open the foam of a great landlocked sea. We can think of the first Europeans venturing beyond their little safe bays and moving from island to island and port to port across and around the Mediterranean. That sea which is surrounded by earth.
In effect, it gives a clear description of how the Greeks started to colonize.
The Greeks and the Phoenicians with their commerce all around. Yes. The Vikings come a bit later. They are further down the page.
That starts with AD. Here you talk about approximately 1000 BC.
Yes.
All spiritual experiences.
Yes.
What shall we know going through? Because after he said, is it being through the pillar rocks, which are the two Arabic?
Yes.
Arabic. So, I think all this is describing here, all
different stages in the development of our consciousness, of the human consciousness and the individual consciousness.
It's more than that.
Well, we'll see as we go on. It says he starts at first in these tiny bays of self, individual experiences, and eventually he becomes an explorer of the unplumbed infinitude, sailing on eternity's seas. So you're right, this is very clearly symbolic, but it's very interesting how this symbolic description can match so closely to actual historical developments that have happened in the story of humanity. Yes.
How does that fit in with previous civilizations like so-called Atlantis, if it ever existed?
Well, he's using these symbols, and whatever those civilizations were, presumably they went through these stages. And we can connect these stages with the gunas. We can say that the first stage is the stage of tamas. No? And the second, this adventuring, risk-taking stage, it's the stage of rajas. And then we go beyond that and beyond that. No? So he shows at least four stages in this passage altogether. So, but this is such a lovely description, no, of the trade around the Mediterranean. No? Reaching unknown harbor lights in distant climes, even the climates are different. And in those places, there are open markets, so people can come from anywhere for life's opulent arts, all the riches and luxuries and outputs of human creativity, rich bales, wonderful woven fabrics. We can think about the Phoenicians with their purple, no? Carved statuettes from all over, hued canvases, paintings even, and jeweled toys brought for an infant's play. An infant is, of course, a young child, but it can also suggest a royal child, a prince. These are luxuries. These are jeweled toys. They're not just for any ordinary child. And perishable products of hard toil, things that are not long-lasting, but still they've taken a great deal of human effort to produce them. They are special products, luxuries, and transient splendor. Some of them really may not last long, but they've won and will be lost by time. And then comes the next stage. Would you read, please?
Or passing through a gate of pillar rocks, venturing not yet to cross ocean's summit, and journeying to a dream of distances, its heavens closed on familiar coast, and finds new heaven in storm-troubled islands, or guided by a sure compass in his heart. He plunges through a bright haze that hides the stars, steering under dread roots of ignorance. His flow pushes towards undiscovered source. He chances on unimagined continents, a seeker of the islands of the blessed. He leaves the last plains, crosses the ultimate seas, returns to eternal things his single quest. Life changes for him. Its time-constructed scenes, its images filling in.
Thank you. So here there are three more stages. This is what the first mariners seem to have done. The pillar rocks. Of course, nowadays there's about 3 miles, I think, between Africa and Europe at the Rock of Gibraltar. But if we follow the ancient mythology, at one time it seems to have been much narrower, and it was a dangerous passage to pass these pillar rocks and go out into the ocean. No? Mm? Yes, please do. Yeah.
You know that what you say came much later in the mythology. At the beginning, the Greek, the two pillars were put by Heracles on his journey, and this was after between the 8th and the 9th labor. The 8th labor is full mastery. Belt of the Amazon. Next one is the cattle of Gerium, the full powers of life. And next, the two other ones are the golden dog of Epirus, and then the apples of Hesperius. So all the Greek Homer and Pindar and all the ancients say no man can pass those pillars. It's impossible on the spiritual journey. That means that no one can go beyond
those realizations.
Full mastery first, which is of the Amazon, and then the beginning of the power of life, cattle of Gerium. And so, as Schrödinger says here, he passed this limit, those two pillars of Heracles. He's the first one, he said, next passage, in the next canto, he was the first one to pass this.
Yes, yeah. Thank you.
And then we've seen a bit later, I talk of the Islam of the Blessed, which we shall see.
Yes, yes. But we can also follow this, at least in our legendary history. I don't know when it actually happened, but this idea of passing out from the landlocked sea into a larger sea, no? And at first, he doesn't dare to cross those unnamed oceans that's not yet named the Atlantic, but it follows. He follows, travels close to unfamiliar shores. We know this is what the Phoenicians did. They followed southward the coast of Africa, and they followed the coast of Europe northwards all the way to the Hebrides. You know, we find remnants of them there. But they just followed the coasts. They didn't start to cross the oceans. No? Venturing not yet to cross oceans unnamed and journey into a dream of distances, it travels close to unfamiliar coasts. This is maybe a stage in our own development when we cross certain limits, but we are not yet ready to lose contact with the firm land altogether. So we follow the coasts in our explorations. But then there comes a stage when, like Columbus, we feel guided by a sure compass in our thoughts. He felt absolutely sure that he can follow this compass of his thought, and if he goes west, he will eventually come around to the east. He felt absolutely confident of that. He didn't need anybody to give him a map. He just followed that compass of his thought. So he plunged into a bright haze that hides the stars. There aren't even any starry lights to guide him. This is completely new territory. But he's steering on what later became the trade routes because of the way that the winds blow, that this journey that he made, these became regular trade routes between Europe and Africa and the Americas, because you could go one way at one season and come back at the other.
What is a sure compass?
Well, a compass, if you look at the compass, which is quite an early development, which we don't know, it seems to have come from the east, it tells you that this is north, so this must be south and this must be east. And no, it's his reason that tells him that this is the way things are and I can rely on it. That becomes a sure compass in the thought. These are stages in the development of the incarnated soul. So the soul follows the development of the physical being. No? Yes. And in this case, I believe it's reason, yes. No? But then he gets this courage that this is the way the wind's going, and his prow pushes towards undiscovered shores. And he chances, like Columbus and Amerigo Vespucci seem to have done, on unimagined continents. They had no idea that those continents were there. Well, Sri Aurobindo's making a connection between, as I said, this kind of history, the trade routes, and what do the trade routes represent symbolically in our development. It's this ignorance, this half-knowledge. Yeah? They're familiar, we trust them, although we don't exactly know where they're going. Yes, right, exactly. Yes, that's what Claude says, actually. This shows really, in one way, on one level, this is about how the Greeks and then other peoples colonized the whole of the shores of the Mediterranean, no? And then went further. So this is partly a history of humanity.
No, I'm saying in the inner development.
In our inner development, it's like
open.
That. New
it's
possibilities.
Yeah,
right, right.
Actually, the Greeks have started to colonize due to lack of basic materials. If you translate them into a spiritual lesson, you have experiences that you need more. So the Greeks, they start at approximately 800 BC because they need metal, iron. Mm. And iron you get in Sardinia, etc., etc.
Yes.
It's a long story, but it's a
legal place for it. There are many legal materials that also.
And then successively you get commerce, but it's not the main reason. Also, the first Greek communities were overcrowded. It's a not fertile land, Greece, so they need to go out. And so there were also philosophies that certain cities should not contain more and a certain number of inhabitants, all these things induces the Greeks to start to live in another country, which they do due to lack of technique and non-secure boats by coastal navigation off from one known to another known island.
So it's wonderful that our actual history of a certain stage of
and
human development.
They keep the Western Mediterranean. As a matter of fact, the columns of Hercules nowadays, they don't place anymore at the Strait of Gibraltar, which traditionally always was said, but more between the African and between the island of Malta and Sicily.
Yes, that
the
was
Phoenician
the
part
was
the
on the west.
So I was going to say the Greek part right here.
But I, what I find marvelous about this passage is the way that Sri Aurobindo weaves together in a single narrative all these different levels of meaning. You know? The history part that has a kind of resonance with us and all these different developments, the psychological part about the gunas and also the spiritual part. And it's not that one comes first and the other comes second. In different parts of the passage, one or the other is dominant. But all this is going on at the same time. This is part of the soul's development in its many births, you know, leading up to the next stage, which is when the soul is seeking the islands of the blessed. They were supposed to be far out west somewhere.
And they are part of the Hades world.
They're part of the what?
Hades, underworld, kingdom of Hades. And
in Celtic mythology, it's something else. It's
it's a part of Hades, and Hades is a part of underworld. This is also in conscious, where we must do the unity of mind and matter and spirit.
But the thing about the Isles of the Blessed is that great spirits go there and they don't have to die. It's a place of immortality, a blessed place. So at a certain stage in our quest, that's what we are looking for, something permanent. No? And then he has to leave all these material lands. He has to cross the ultimate seas. He has to turn to eternal things, this symbol quest. The whole quest has been a symbol, is a symbol, but it has to go beyond the things that happen in earthly history and the normal psychological development of a human being. And when he does that, then this life changes for him. Significance of all these time-constructed scenes changes completely. He sees that these are images veiling infinity. And then there even comes a passage which seems to refer to space flight. No? Earth's borders recede, and the terrestrial air hangs round him no longer. It's translucent veil. He's crossed beyond the limit of mortal thought and hope. He's reached the world's end and stares beyond. And while this might refer to space flight, it also very, very clearly refers to a conscious spiritual quest. The eyes of mortal body plunge their gaze into eyes that look upon eternity. And the time traveler realizes, the soul realizes, that it has to explore a greater world, not just this material one.
It is about the soul.
The soul is the traveler.
Then here it is that as many in three lines Sri Aurobindo says that, but dares at last, and then again dares not to affront, and then again about daring. So is it the soul also?
You can say the soul at certain stages of its development has certain barriers to cross, no? And that requires courage, and more than courage, aspiration, daring. So with these lines mark those points of transition and further development.
Mm-hmm. So, but I have a feeling that my soul doesn't...
You are thinking of the spark of divinity within us, which is always perfect.
Yes.
And pure, no?
But
that soul, that spark of divinity, has accepted to incarnate in this material world. Mm-hmm. And then it takes on itself the limitations, the karma. It accepts, we read about how it accepts to follow the laws of nature, the whims of nature. Mm-hmm. So here now he's showing us about how the developing soul begins to overcome one limitation after another limitation and becomes more and more conscious. Is it clear? Here it was specifically about the soul who has incarnated in the material world and accepted the rule of nature. So spirit, like we have matter, and we have living matter, and we have mentalized matter. There's also spirit, which has much higher possibilities. And that will be the next stage. Do you want to read to the end of the section? Shall we go a little bit further?
Sure.
Karen?
I went
a bit further.
Yeah, what's for which I just start where you stopped?
Yes.
Earth's borders recede and the terrestrial air hangs around him no longer its translucent veil. He has crossed the limit of mortal thought and hope. He has reached the world's end and stares beyond. The eyes of mortal body plunge their gaze into eyes that look upon eternity. A greater world time's traveler must explore. At last he hears a chanting on the heights and the far speaks and the unknown grows near. He crosses the boundaries of the unseen and passes over the edge of mortal sight to a new vision of himself and things. He is a spirit in an unfinished world that knows him not and cannot know itself. The surface symbol of his goalless quest takes deeper meanings to his inner view. His is a search of darkness for the light, of mortal life for immortality.
Thank you. So this is the great step that Sri Aurobindo is helping us to take, to go beyond our mortal sight, our sight dominated by ignorance and death, which sees only the physical world. We move on to a new vision of ourselves and of things and of the world. We begin to know, to recognize that each of us is a spirit and that this world we are in is an unfinished world. So this unfinished world can't know about our inner being and cannot know itself. So this quest which has been going on throughout the history of humanity takes on deeper meanings to the inner view, to the inner mind and consciousness. And we recognize that what we are doing, we are representing the whole material universe. We are taking part in this search of darkness, the darkness of unconsciousness, for the light of supreme consciousness. We're taking part in this search of mortal life, life that's dominated by the limitations of matter, of the physical. We are searching for the immortal state. And we're not doing this only for ourselves. This is part of a much vaster project. I think we'll stop there for today. So let's listen to Mother reading some of these passages. And I think that's what he will emphasize now in the last page that we'll read next week. Thanks to Shobindo.